Stuart Allen speaking from the Chapel of the Open Book, Wilson Street Chapel, London. We are continuing our series in the consideration of the Authorized Version and some of the changed meanings of words. Some of these words have completely changed their meaning since the 17th century. Some have dropped right out of use. So we ought to inquire as to what the modern meaning of these words are, otherwise we shall seriously misunderstand the context in which they occur. Now, the first one I want to look at today is the word curious. Curious. Today we use it of something that's peculiar, a little bit odd. We talk about a curious fact, or we even talk about people being a little bit curious, a little bit out of the ordinary. That was not the meaning in 1611, and it's never used in that sense in the Bible. Let's turn to the book of Exodus, chapter 28. In connection with the ephod of the priest, the priest's garments, Exodus 28 and verse 6, they shall make the ephod of gold, of blue, of purple, scarlet, twine linen, with cunning. Well, there's another old English word, but I think most of us know what that means. It's not, this word today has got a bad meaning. We talk about someone being cunning. That's not a compliment. But this meant clever. Old English, clever work. A cunning workman. A cunning man was a clever workman in the year 1611. But you see, this is something very beautiful. I want you to see it. Look at the colours used. Gold and blue, purple and scarlet and twine linen. Now, verse 8. And the curious girdle of the ephod which is upon it. That doesn't mean to say this is a peculiar kind of thing or odd. The word means to be made with care. It means to be something that is artistic and beautiful, skillfully made. We would say today a work of art would be used in the sense that this word curious was used. And so, this ephod was a work of art. Look at all the colours used. Something extremely beautiful to look at. You can't imagine the high priest looking odd the time he was dressed up in this way, because that wouldn't have invited any worship at all. But this was something that was really good and wonderful to look at. Let's go to the Psalms. In a very difficult passage, actually, Psalm 139. Psalm 139. A verse 15. Let's look at the previous verse to get the context. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvellous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Not peculiarly wrought, beautifully, artistically worked or wrought. Do you see, the formation of the human body before birth is likened in a beautiful figure to a piece of tapestry that's being made with all the colours woven together, something extremely beautiful. That's what God's doing. The formation of a human body, not something that's peculiar, something that's artistic. Surely one of the most wonderful of God's works is the human body. God the artist. We think of God in all sorts of ways, but do we ever think of him as the most supreme artist? Well, of course he is. Because this world, to anyone that's got any eyes to see at all, there's still evidences of the beauty of God, the beauty of creation, the beauty of a lovely sunset, the beauty of leaf and flower that's still around us in spite of sin and death. Who made it? It was conceived in the mind of a very beautiful person. That was our Saviour, because by him all things were made. I've said this before, but I think it's a line of thought which we would do good sometimes to meditate on. How beautiful God must be. We don't think of him as being beautiful. We think of him as being majestic, tremendous, almost terrific, we might say. Almighty, omnipresent, all these things, and they're all true. But he's beautiful. And when, in the end, through redemption, all the redeemed are conformed to the image of his Son, as Romans 8 says, there's going to be a beautiful race. Real beauty at last. Now we've only got a very poor sort of expression of it. Then will be the reality. Well, this is a lovely figure then of the preparation of the human body before birth, not being peculiar, but something that's artistic, everything put into its place as a lovely work of art. Now let's go to another word which has changed its meaning. It's got now quite a bad meaning, the word damnation. And most Christians keep that word to anyone that is going to hell. They say, you'll receive damnation. Now the word in the Greek is just the ordinary word to judge. It doesn't always have a bad meaning. You can judge righteously, you see. It cuts both ways. We ought to always drop that word damnation and translate it judgment. Let's see one case where it is used in a bad way. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. The apostle here is dealing with some of the abuses in this church. There were some who were carnal, not spiritual. He had to tell them that very plainly. There were abuses in connection with the Lord's table. And in verse 28, let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. Note, he was to examine and judge himself. No one else was to do it. No one else was to play the part of a pope and say, here, out you. You go out. We'll excommunicate you. No, you examine yourself. For he that eateth, now here's the warning, and drinketh unworthily, eateth and drinks damnation, judgment, to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. There's no thought here that if a believer did eat or drink unworthily, he'd go to hell. That's not the meaning of the term. It's got now far too strong a meaning. Condemnation, judgment, is the meaning always. Now, a word that's used often today, but completely altered from its original meaning, is this word delicately. We talk about a delicate person doing something delicately, fastidiously, almost the word means now. You turn to the Gospel of Luke, and the 7th chapter. Here's the Lord describing the ministry of John the Baptist. Verse 24. And when the messengers of John were departed, he, as the Lord, began to speak to the people concerning John. What went ye out into the wilderness to see? A reed, shaken with the wind? But what went ye out in order for, that is, to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they which are gorgeously apparelled and live delicately are in king's courts. Now, in no sense can this word delicately have its modern meaning. It originally meant luxuriously. Obviously, if a person was living in the king's court, they would be living in luxury, not in poverty. And that's what the Lord is meaning. Are you expecting to see a man that's living in the king's court dressed luxuriously, living like that? Well, we said you'll be disappointed. John isn't like that. Living luxuriously. Here's another word which is now completely dropped out of modern English. The word E-A-R. But somebody will say, the part of the head that you listen with. Yes, I know, that's a substantive, the ear. But I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to how it's used in the Bible as a verb, to ear something. And I'm not dropping my H's, friends, either, when I'm saying that. You see? To ear something. Let's go to Genesis chapter 45. Verse 6, this is Joseph speaking to his brethren. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in the which there shall neither be earring, and it doesn't mean an earring either, earring or harvest. I'll take you to one more, this time the prophecy of Isaiah, and the 30th chapter. Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 24. Here's God telling the people of Israel the blessings that they're finally going to have in restoration. Verse 24. The oxen likewise and the young asses that ear the ground, E-A-R, that ear the ground shall eat clean provender. Well, in the 17th century, to ear was to plough the land. To plough the land. And it's completely obsolete today. I want you now to turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, because there are 2 obsolete words in one verse in that 3rd chapter of the 1st epistle of Peter. 1 Peter chapter 3. Verse 11, let him eschew evil and do good. Let him seek peace and ensue it. Eschew and ensue. Well, ensue means to seek after, to strive for, to put out effort for. You could translate it by another English word, something like it, pursue, if you like, and you'd have a modern word. So, we render it. Let him seek peace and seek after it, strive for it. This is something that's worthwhile, says the apostle. But what about this word eschew? Well, do you remember Job? Job was an upright man who eschewed evil. Eschewed it. The word means to avoid danger. To avoid something that's bad. Deliberately avoiding a certain thing. Which is bad. And here it is, of course, evil. Let him avoid, turn aside from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and strive for it, is what Peter is actually saying. So we've got 2 obsolete words there in one verse. Now, a very common word today, which has quite a different meaning in the Bible, is the word equal. Now, we talk about things being equal. We make a comparison. Something is equal to something else. That is not the way it's used generally in our English version, but in the Old English, it had a moral meaning. Not merely comparing substances, neither in weight or in quality. It had a moral meaning in the 16th and 17th centuries. It comes from the old Latin word equus, which means fair, or just, or right, and is not merely dealing with size at all. Now look at a very important passage in Ezekiel, chapter 18. The prophecy of Ezekiel, chapter 18. Here's an argument that God has with the people of Israel. Verse 25. Yet, he says, you say, we ought to read the previous verse, when the righteous turns away from his righteousness and commits iniquity, and doeth according to all the abominations that the wicked man doeth, shall he live? God's asking the question. All his righteousness that he hath done shall not be mentioned. in his trespass that he hath trespassed, and in his sin that he hath sinned, in them shall he die. Yet you say, the way of the Lord isn't equal. Well, equal to what? What's the Lord comparing his way with? Well, he's not comparing it with anything. Equal. The word means just or right. You're saying my ways aren't just. You're criticizing me, God says. What right have you got to do that? You're saying my way isn't just. Hear now, O house of Israel, is not your way just, not just, you see? Is not your way unequal, unjust? He's saying the way you look at things is unjust, wrong. My ways are right and fair. God is even asking people to weigh what he's doing up. And he says, you'll have to say that my ways are fair and just and right. Not in the sense of being equal today. Not in that sense at all. Coming to another word again, commonly used today, to expect. You expect something to happen. It has changed its meaning slightly, as Hebrews chapter 10 makes clear. In connection with the Lord, in his ascension and his present position in glory. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 12. This man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, this was the perfect thing. All the others were pictures and had to be repeated. This is the one necessary offering. He sat down, showing the work was completed and finished on the right hand of God. From henceforth, expecting. What's he expecting? Well, he's waiting. That's the meaning of the word. The waiting Christ. Again, here's something we might think about a little more. The Christ of glory. The Christ that's ascended at the right hand of the Father. That's exalted far above all heavens, as Ephesians says. Yes, you say, well, he deserves that. Doesn't Philippians tell us of that great descent and then the great ascent back to glory again? Giving him the name which is above every name. The Father's highly exalted him. Perfectly true. But at the same time, remember, there's something that's yet not complete for the Lord. He's waiting for something. That ascended Lord is waiting. And the waiting Christ, the patience of Christ, isn't it marvelous? I think he's waited for centuries. He's waiting here for the redemption of his people till they're home with him, and the other side for his enemies to be made his footstool. The gathering in of his people, which would be the climax of their redemption, and the putting away of his people's enemies. Because that's the complete picture God gives of redemption. The salvation of his people, bringing them to their home at last, and the ridding of his people's enemies, the taking out of all things that offend from the kingdom of God. So expect there means to wait. But let's take the noun, expectation. Psalm 62. Psalm 62, verse 5. My soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from him. But what are you expecting? The word just means plain hope. He's stating just where he finds his hope. My hope is in God, says the psalmist. He's not really expecting anything particular, but the hope. You could say he's expecting his realization, if you like. But it just meant our modern English word, hope. Proverbs, next book, chapter 24. Proverbs 24. Verse 14. So shall the knowledge of wisdom be unto thy soul, when thou hast found it, then there shall be a reward, and thy expectation shall not be cut off. Your hope will not be cut off. You'll not be taken from, or the hope that you have will is certainly realized. You will not lose your hope. Your expectation shall not be cut off. Or, a most important one in Jeremiah chapter 29. Here's God telling his people, warning them about the captivity, 70 years judgment that's going to be in Babylon because of their sin. Verse 10, for thus saith the Lord, that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place. That's restoration, isn't it, after judgment. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace, not of evil, to give you an expected end. An expected end. Literally, a future and a hope. I'm going to give you a hope and a future. It almost looked as though the great judgment that was going to fall was going to finish them, because God was going to allow the temple to be smashed, Jerusalem to be smashed, the whole of the people to be deported. You'd say, well, that's the end of them then. Finish. No, says God, no, it isn't. I'm going to give you a hope. And I'm going to give you a future in spite of this. Because, of course, God had made a promise to Abraham concerning his seed. And had that happened, that Nebuchadnezzar would have destroyed the people and finished them, God's promise to that man would have been annihilated. And he would have broken his word. That cannot be. So, I'm going to give you a hoped-for end. I'm going to give you a future and a hope that's going to be realized. Another old English word, which I think most of us probably know. F-A-I-N, fain. You've never used that word, have you? Fain. And you remember where it comes? In the parable, the well-known parable of the prodigal son. Going away from the father's home, going into the far country, fooling his time away, losing all his money, and at last being reduced to penury. And you're told he would have fain eaten pig's food. He would have fain. Fain. The word means gladly. Gladly. He would have gladly had pig's will for his food. So far had he gone right away from the father's home. Fain, old English, gladly. Another expression which has completely changed is the expression that Paul uses in 1 Thessalonians, to be feeble-minded. Now that brings to our mind somebody that's mental, as we say. We say these poor people that are in mental homes, they're feeble-minded. Paul didn't mean it like that at all. So we'll turn to 1 Thessalonians, and the 5th chapter. 1 Thessalonians, and the 5th chapter, and verse 14. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, be patient to all men. This meant discouraged. A person could be perfectly normal mentally, but if they were discouraged, they would be feeble-minded. We would probably say today, faint-hearted. If you find any amongst you that are faint-hearted, well, comfort them, strengthen them. Faint-hearted, not mentally weak. Discouraged would probably be a far better translation. Now, I've got an extraordinary expression which occurs several times in the Bible, and you must have come across it. And it's this, to fetch a compass. Do you know what that means? And it does not mean to get hold of a compass that tells you where the north is, the magnetic north. To fetch a compass. Let's go back to the book of Numbers. If ever there was a need for a modern translation, it's when you come across expressions like this. Numbers 34. God speaking to Moses concerning the people of Israel and their journey. Numbers 34, verse 5. And the border shall fetch a compass from Asmon unto the river of Egypt. and the goings out of it shall be at the sea. The border shall fetch a compass. Let's look at another occurrence. In the second book of Samuel, chapter 5, God speaking this time to David. Verse 22. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, Thou shalt not go up, but fetch a compass behind them. Fetch a compass behind them. What on earth was that for? And come upon them over against the mulberry trees. Well, the word system means to go into a circle. It has nothing to do with what we call a compass at all. It means to make a circuit, to go in a roundabout course, to turn. And it means here, go round to their rear. Approach them from the rear, go round in a circle behind them. Let's look at one example of the New Testament where that occurs. In Acts chapter 28, the last chapter of the Acts of the Apostles. Acts chapter 28. This is describing, of course, the voyage, the sea voyage, from Malta to Rome. Verse 12. And landing at Syracuse, we tarried there, we waited there 3 days, and from thence we fetched a compass. You must have read that quite a number of times. We fetched a compass and came to Regium. We went round in a circle. We made a circuit, went round in a circle, and came to Regium, because the wind was blowing so hard. You see? That's why they had to do it. To fetch a compass to go in a circle. One more, perhaps two more we have time for in this study. A very common word we use today is to foretell. And it means just to predict today. But not so in 1600. The word had a sinister meaning, and it meant to warn, not merely to predict. If you foretold something to somebody, you'd be giving them a warning. See the way Paul uses it in 2 Corinthians, chapter 13. 2 Corinthians, chapter 13. Remember the abuses that were going on in this church. This is what the apostle had to say when he wrote them in this second letter. This is the third time I am coming to you. In the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. I told you before and foretell you. Well, now that shows this is no ordinary word, because we don't talk about foretelling anybody. We talk about foretelling facts or predicting. But I foretell you, he said, you Christians, as if I were present. The second time. I'm warning you. I'm not simply telling you something's going to happen. Something would happen, of course, if they didn't obey his warning. But I'm warning you. As if I were present the second time. And being absent now, I write to them which heretofore have sinned. And all others. If I come again, I will not spare. I'm warning. To foretell meant to warn. Not merely to state a fact would happen. And the last one we're going to look at today is the word fray, to fray. Again, an obsolete word. It's a shortened form of the word afray. And you can hear it coming out in modern English, afraid. Only this time the ending is fraid, whereas the original was fraye. You see, fray, fray. It's simply the past participle of this verb, to be afraid. And so what it does mean is to be afraid or to be terrified. But we use the word afraid today. To frighten. Deuteronomy chapter 28. The book of Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 26.
And thy carcass shall be meat. Now this is the warning God is giving to this people. Thy carcass shall be meat unto all the birds of the air, the fowls of the air, and to the beasts of the earth, and no man shall fray them away. No man shall frighten them away. These are the savage beasts, the savage animals. There'll be nobody to protect you from them, God said. These savage animals will come, and they'll consume you. No man shall fray them away. Or just one important occurrence of it in connection with prophecy, found in the book of Zechariah, the first chapter. The prophecy of Zechariah, the first chapter. The vision of the horns and the smiths. The second of these eight visions which God gave to Zechariah. Verse 20. The Lord showed me four carpenters, literally workmen. Not necessarily people that worked in wood either. A person that worked in metal would be a carpenter in those days. Then said I, what do these come to do? What's their object? He spoke saying, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head. But these workmen are come to fray them, F-R-A-Y, are come to fray them, and to cast out the horns of the Gentiles, which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah, to scatter it. These second four, are come to frighten them, are come to terrify the first ones. To terrify them, to frighten them. Well, I think that is all we can accomplish in this study. Again, I would like to say, and I hope, that you are finding this series helpful, not just merely being technical. I don't want to be just technical. I've said this before. But I do hope you've seen that some of these passages, at least, are more than interesting. They are important to doctrine. Important to doctrine. And therefore, I don't think we are wasting our time when we try and get what is the modern English equivalent of some of these words. Now, next time, I'm going to start off with a word that occurs a number of times in the Bible, but we don't use today, froward. Have you met anybody that's froward? Word that occurs a number of times in the Bible, what does it mean? Can we be froward? Well, we can. The thing is to understand, of course, what it means. And then we have the very Old English, used in the Old English sense, although we have it today, but completely changed its meaning, the word ghost. Now, people are frightened of ghosts, apparitions. It's never used like that in 1600. What about the expression, the Holy Ghost? The Holy Ghost. And because of the Old English, I think it's just as well that we change it. But I want to show you that the word has nothing to do with apparition at all. That in our next study, God willing, next time.